demand because economies are bouncing back from the pandemic. In the EU, last winter and spring were colder than usual, and so gas reserves in the 27-nation bloc were hit. Since then, power grids have not benefited much from wind energy due to mild weather conditions. Moscow and Berlin want the speedy approval of Nord Stream 2, the controversial pipeline under the Baltic Sea that will double Russian gas exports to Germany. Completed earlier this month, the pipeline cannot start delivering gas until it clears regulatory hurdles here in the European Commission. The United States is very much against the Russian-German gas pipeline, and analysts say Washington is putting the EU under pressure to try and delay things. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Muslims marked Arbaeen, the 40th day that followed the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the third Shia Imam and his 72 strong companions in the Battle of Karbala in what is now southern Iraq in 680 AD. Each year, millions of Muslim mourners set out on a symbolic 80-kilometer-long walk that begins from the holy city of Najaf in Iraq, where Imam Hussein's father Imam Ali's shrine is located, to the holy city of Karbala that houses Imam Hussein's shrine. But this year, due to COVID-19 pandemic, Iraq has imposed restrictions on the number of pilgrims. According to Iranian officials, nearly 60,000 Iranian pilgrims have traveled to Iraq to partake in the huge annual Arbaeen procession. The Arbaeen march is of great significance for Muslims. In Iran, those who cannot make it to Karbala take part in a symbolic march from Tehran to the town of Ray towards the holy shrine of Hazrat Abdulazim Hassani.
Arbaeen march is one of the largest religious gatherings in the world, which manifests the extent of the age of love for Imam Hussein and his ideology of resistance against injustice. This year, although the COVID-19 pandemic has either cancelled or restricted most of the mourning processions, our love for Imam Hussein runs deep in our hearts and will never fade away.
The love for Imam Hussein runs in our family. My family and I always take part in such religious ceremonies to remember Imam Hussein, because with his sacrifice, he saved the true Islam. Still after 14 centuries, we honor him as a savior of our religion, and he's the best role model for me and my children.
Over the past decade, the Iranian and Iraqi people have begun participating in what came to be known as the Great Walk of Arbaeen, a procession during which millions of Iranian and Iraqi Shias travel on foot to the shrine city of Karbala, south of Iraq, to renew allegiance with the ideals and teachings of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The Battle of Karbala featured an unjust fight between Imam Hussein and his army and the hugely outnumbered army of the Umayyad Caliph of the time, Yazid.
The Day of Arbaeen is a day on which the family members of Imam Hussein return to the plain of Karbala to properly bid farewell to their fallen heroes and finally grieve for their loved ones. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
February 3rd, 2021. Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, is the leading lady of all the women of the world. At a young age, Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, achieved such a high level of spirituality that according to certain narration, the angels spoke and showed some truth to her. She was called Al-Muhaddatha, which means someone who is with whom the angel speaks. When reading this application for visiting the shrine of Imam Rida alayhi salam, when it comes to sending our greeting to Hazrat Zahra, peace be upon her, she is referred to as Al-Tahira, Al-Muhaddatha, Al-Taqiyya, Al-Naqiyya, Al-Radiyya, Al-Zakiyya. Hazrat Zahra, purity has been expressed using different expressions: purity of the spirit, purity of the heart, purity of the mind, purity of one's lap, and purity throughout all of life. Well, these are practical expressions and teaches us something. We would try to cleanse and purify ourselves without having a pure inner being. We cannot achieve lofty positions, nor can we get close to the heaven of these great personalities' guardianship. So purity of one's inner being is achieved through piety and righteousness. Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, was an exalted scholar in knowledge. Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, delivered a sermon in the Medina Mosque after the demise of the Prophet, about which Allama al-Majlisi said, "Eloquent writers and scholars should sit down and interpret its word and phrases." This is such an insightful and meaningful sermon. Perhaps for an hour, she spoke with the best, most beautiful phrases and the finest well-selected terminology. In the period after the Prophet, peace be upon him, migration to Medina, Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, was at the beginning of the minimum of age of marriage. At the time, she married Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, and her dowry and wedding gift, perhaps you all know, were very simple and very little. This is how the marriage ceremony of the daughter of the first person in the Islamic world was conducted.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has ordered the army to remain on standby to help fuel reach petrol stations hit by panic buying, as Labour Party leader Keir Starmer and businesses called on him to get a grip on the shortages rippling across Britain's economy. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Rowena Mason, Aubrey Allegretti, Dan Sabag, and Richard Partington. The piece is titled Boris Johnson Puts Army on Standby Amid Fuel Supply Crisis. Stay with us for more. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has ordered the army to remain on standby to help fuel reach petrol stations hit by panic buying, as Labour Party leader Keir Starmer and businesses called on him to get a grip on the shortages rippling across Britain's economy. Number 10 Downing Street said army drivers would be ready to help deliver petrol and diesel on a short-term basis, but stopped short of an immediate deployment, even though some essential workers have not been able to carry out their jobs without fuel. The decision was taken at a meeting of cabinet ministers on Monday, 27th of September, as the industry said consumer panic rather than real shortages was the main driver of the problems and predicted that it would ease within days. People continue to queue at fuel stations in spite of government warnings that drivers trying to top up were making the situation worse. Kwasi Kwarteng, the business secretary, said it was right for the government to take sensible precautionary steps. The United Kingdom continues to have strong supplies of fuel. However, we are aware of supply chain issues at fuel station forecourts and are taking steps to ease these as a matter of priority, Kwasi Kwarteng said. He added, if required, the deployment of military personnel will provide the supply chain with additional capacity as a temporary measure to help ease pressures caused by spikes in localized demand for fuel. The government also authorized an extension to licenses for fuel tankers, automatically renewing them without refresher training. A joint statement from fuel industry released by the government said companies expect the situation to ease in the coming days because many cars are now holding more fuel than usual. The companies, including BP, Shell and Esso, said there was plenty of fuel at UK refineries and terminals, and as an industry we're working closely with the government to help ensure fuel is available to be delivered to petrol stations across the country. Number 10 Downing Street and ministers did discuss a plan for more immediate deployment of military drivers, but decided to hold off for now. The Ministry of Defence, the MOD, was sent a military aid to civil authority request to ensure that about 100 troops would be ready for action. Labour Party leader Keir Starmer accused Boris Johnson of having allowed the situation to spiral out of control, despite months of warnings from industry. The consequences of Boris Johnson's failure to prepare or plan are being felt across the country, Starmer said. The government must now bring together businesses and trade unions to develop a proper plan, both for the immediate crisis as well as to tackle the long-term issues that have led us here. Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrat leader, said the government should already have had troops on standby, as he did as Energy Secretary when the threat of a fuel shortage loomed in 2012. Someone in government needs to explain their incompetence, and there must be a case for someone to resign, whether it's Transport Secretary Grant Shapps, Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng, or someone in the Ministry of Defence. But this is shockingly bad government, he added. The British Medical Association, BMA, called for emergency measures to let medical staff fill up, warning that as pumps run dry, there is a real risk that NHS staff won't be able to do their jobs. Dr. Chand Nagpal, the British Medical Association Council Chair said, emergency and essential workers rely on fuel both to travel to work and for their work itself. Whether this is to get to hospitals, practices and other healthcare settings, or for ambulances to reach people in urgent need of care and GPs to visit very ill patients at home. Sadiq Khan, the Labour Mayor of London, also called for priority petrol stations for key workers. He said, as the current reductions in fuel delivery affect petrol stations across the capital, it is essential that key workers are able to get fuel to travel to work and provide the services our city needs. Meanwhile, the Confederation of British Industries, CBI, called on the government to do more to anticipate wider problems with shortages that are likely to carry on hitting the economy while labour shortages continue. Tony Danker, Director General of the Confederation of British Industries, CBI, said, there are labour shortages across the economy, and of course, the government is right that in the long run, we can't simply turn to immigration to solve those problems. But in the short run, there is no solution other than to look that way. Pump prices for fuel in the United Kingdom have reached their highest level in 8 years as petrol stations run dry amid panic buying, with a further jump expected as wholesale energy costs continue to surge. Figures from the RAC showed that the average price of a litre of petrol rose from 135.9 pence on Friday to 136.6 pence on Sunday, the highest level since September of 2013. As queues continued to form at forecourts on Monday after a chaotic weekend, the AA warned that prices could rise further this autumn as the global oil price soars to its highest level in 3 years. Hoyer, which delivers petrol for BP, said it had 50 vacancies in its fuel fleet of about 1,200 vehicles and called on motorists to stop panic buying. Meanwhile, surplus goods firm Wholesale Clearance UK said it had sold out of jerry cans over the weekend as motorists stockpiled fuel.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
It's the fourth day of long lines and dry pumps in Britain, and the army is preparing to help with a fuel supply problem. The rise in demand came amid fears of a driver shortage hitting fuel supply. The UK is set to be short of 100,000 truck drivers, causing problems for food suppliers and supermarkets. Now, this is set to be the result of new Brexit visa regulations and also a COVID backlog. Now, let's go to London to our own Amina Taylor, and let's hear her tell us about the situation there. Amina, over to you.
Well, unfortunately, it would have been another worrying day for consumers as they perhaps worried about how they might get to work, to school, and go about their daily lives tomorrow. Because despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson making his first on-camera comments about this, saying the situation was returning to some kind of satisfactory levels and that consumers must go about their petrol filling business in the normal way in order to help regulate the supplies at the pumps, the Petrol Retailers Association, that's the main group who looks after four courts here, who represent those members, say still nearly 40% of their four courts are empty. Now, if you extrapolate from the information, even if you can find a place with a long line, you're actually in the minority here because a lot of the petrol pumps are running dry. When I filed my story on this yesterday, we drove to six places hoping to speak to people in those long lines, and there were none because the forecourts were empty. So Grant Shapps, the transport secretary here, has placed the blame firmly on hauliers, the haulage industry, and also on consumers for panic buying. But I think the messaging coming out of Downing Street and the government might not really be matching the reality on the ground as people see empty forecourts and, of course, long lines if they're lucky enough to see those. This has also very briefly turned into a political situation with Sir Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, saying he would be handling things in a different way, prioritizing key workers and extending the visa program to ensure experienced HGV drivers from across the UK and EU can actually help alleviate the situation.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm Anna Taylor in London. Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. In this edition, we're discussing the fuel crisis in the UK. To do that, I'll be joined by co-founder of the regional investment platform, Justin Eric Ward Stewart in London, and filmmaker and activist Ken Farrow, also in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Let me start with Justin. A fourth day of long lines, Justin, as you heard, and pump closures as prices rise to eight-year highs. And there are instances of violence between angry customers and tensions as tensions are rising. How bad is the situation, in your opinion?
It's been really quite pathetic when you actually see what's happened and how it's been handled. But it does vary hugely across the country. There are some areas where I came across, I was in North England yesterday, and there were very little issues so much there. But other areas, no, it really has been dreadful. And of course, when people are desperate because they need their transport, maybe it's not just for their work, but for medical issues, all sorts of elements, if people cannot get it, and there are queues growing too long, or, as often you'll find with petrol stations, there are two entrances. So you end up immediately with an argument between two queues as to who's getting what. But that, as you were just, Amina was just saying, we've had a distinct lack of political leadership to try and manage our way out of this. This, after all, is nothing new. This was predicted over 18 months ago. And yet we find ourselves in a position where politicians are looking at some surprise, saying, we didn't think this was going to happen. Oh, yes, you did. You just you didn't prepare for it.
Right. Now, our second guest is also joining us, Ken Farrow, filmmaker and activist in London. Good to have you with us, Ken. Boris Johnson's government has announced a series of emergency measures to address the fuel crisis. So how is the fuel crisis being tackled?
Well, it's being tackled quite incompetently, but what we have to remember is that the crisis itself is not just around fuel, it's around the very infrastructure of the United Kingdom that relies on foreign workers, migrant workers, who were told to leave this country. And so I don't think this is just about fuel. This crisis is about the future of this country in terms of its workforce. It has a diminishing workforce, and this is just the first sign of many things to come. So whatever the government does or doesn't do in this situation, it really isn't going to make any difference in the long run until they address the very fundamental nature of work, workers' rights, the rights of workers who come to Britain. And so that has to be the solution. So the solutions in terms of the army and the small number of licenses being offered, and even those are restricted, are just a smokescreen for the bigger issues here, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Now, Justin, how big a role does Brexit play in this fuel crisis besetting Britain?
I think in many ways it's almost a backdrop to the whole thing. There are many issues which have affected what's happened to this. The pandemic, the ping-demic, as we like to call it, because of the app we have on our phones, and also the level of concern, because people have been off on furlough for so long. But Brexit is lurking behind it. Now, let's be fair, there are a shortage of drivers throughout the whole of Europe, very significant numbers indeed. It's almost a generational issue that people don't want to go back to working in really very poor quality in terms of pay and conditions for such a vital issue. What the pandemic brought out was how weak our supply chains were, not just coming from, say, the Far East and the difficulties there because of the pandemic, let alone from the odd ship getting stuck in the Suez Canal. But actually this issue with regard to domestic supply chains, and it's not just about fuel. There's no shortage of fuel at all, but actually making sure the structure is there to make sure food, essential items are being delivered on time. And people's expectations, of course, over the past few years, have said that they expect it there to be immediately. But this is what's so frustrating about what we've seen with this. Brexit has meant that a proportion of the workforce have gone back. And of course, although the government has come up with a temporary scheme for 3 months, no person in their right mind is going to come back just for 3 months, and they'll probably be told to go home again just over the Christmas holiday period. And any politicians who are seriously putting that forward as an answer to this is frankly deluded.
Now, Ken, how about COVID-19? You know, coronavirus backlog is also blamed for this fuel problem.
Well, I think the experience of COVID and the way the country fundamentally ground to a halt in terms of economic development acted as a buffer for the impact of Brexit. Now that the country's coming out of COVID and that there's a much more economic activity, people need to start moving around. And so we're beginning to see the impact of the effects of Brexit with this so-called fuel distribution crisis. But also I think we're going to be seeing it in the future in terms of other areas as well. So what essentially happened in COVID is that the country fundamentally shut down to a greater extent. We had stops and starts over different periods, but it didn't really get on its feet in economic terms. And now that we're apparently coming out of COVID and that economic activity is increasing, we have this issue coming up. And I think it's going to the impact of COVID was to act as a buffer to the bad planning, mismanagement, and basically foolish acts of the British government in terms of Brexit.
Okay, Justin, do you share the same view?
Yeah, and Brexit, if you just want a straightforward calculation, you're knocking about 2 billion value off the British economy. Now, billions are one of those numbers that you can't actually, most people can't get their head around. It's a lot of money. And at a time when the economy is supposed to be trying to recover, you've automatically taken away linkage to the largest trading bloc in the world. Now, this is what is so ridiculous. The largest trading bloc in the world, where Britain was not only a member of, but has significant influences as one of the major powers in it. So actually, this has made the EU significantly weaker as well, because Germany is desperate to reform the EU, But as their previous finance minister said, it's all very well trying to reform it, but they can't do that with Luxembourg and Denmark. They need someone with a big budget and political strength to see it through. So the impact also on the EU is there, but I have to say that the bad handling by our politicians with regard to Brexit, ending up with a populist vote for people voting to leave without really understanding the fundamental issues behind all of this.
Well, unfortunately, we lost a connection with Justin. Let me ask you this. Labour has said that the latest response to the fuel crisis is an admission of failure and that asking the army to pitch in is a sticking plaster. Do you have the same opinion?
In a sense, I do. I mean, clearly, it's not a solution to distribution. And, you know, the British government and the army could very, very quickly solve this situation in terms of physical distribution. But I think what's at stake here, there are two issues that we really need to talk about in relation to your question. One is that Labour have consistently failed the rights of migrant workers. And migrant workers are the very group of people who sustain the infrastructure of the country, whether it's to do with food, whether it's to do with transport, whether it's to do with the National Health Service. So they're a very, very important part of that workforce. And of course, Labour have done nothing to support those groups. And even looking at the party conference at the moment, they're doing very little to actually move forward in terms of that. But I think what we're discussing here is basically, you know, we have a capitalist system which has seen a hiccup. But at the same time, out of every crisis, just as we had the kind of corruption that we witnessed with politicians in Britain in terms of providing jobs and contracts to their friends who exploited the situation in terms of COVID, in terms of PPE, and the supply of medical, we're seeing the same things going on now in terms of the petroleum companies who will benefit from this situation. So I think there's a bigger picture here in terms of just discussing about how do we get the country running again? Well, right. What country do we want to have running again? So I think these are important questions.
Okay, Justin, sorry for that technical problem. We lost our connection for a few seconds. Go ahead with your comments.
Yes, so the issue is one of what you find yourself with actually losing your connection with the largest trading bloc in the world is frankly stupid. Because the wealth that actually Britain has acquired since joining the EU was huge, and none of that was properly discussed at the time of the vote. But Britain has benefited when it joined the the EEC in those days. It was the poor man of Europe. When we left, we weren't necessarily the richest, but certainly one of the wealthiest, and really seemed to be quite a successful economy, despite many difficult issues and longer-term elements, which Phil has just highlighted there, which weren't being properly addressed in terms of not just low pay, but actually the ability to make sure you've got immigrants coming to work here. Because after all, remember, Britain is an immigrant country. Actually, the entire country is made up of waves upon it, and our success has always been our acceptance of and taking in those people. And we're going to see a lot more of that over the next few years. Bear in mind, we've probably got 300,000 people potentially coming from Hong Kong, which I think will be extremely exciting for Britain. But for the reaction of our politicians, I fear they are far more old-fashioned in their attitudes and more Luddite in their behavior, rather than seeing the economic possibilities that this could create.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ken, do you believe that the measures the British government has taken are sufficient to tackle the issue? You know, there are some measures like temporarily exempting fuel companies from competition law.
Well, I think out of every crisis, whether it's man-made or whether it's natural, you know, there are elements within the government and within society that exploit that situation. So I think that there's money being made at the moment out of this crisis, and we can see that just on a basic level in terms of people kind of stocking up on fuel and doing a run on fuel, which now becomes more demanding, more in demand and more expensive, right to the top where you have these companies who have no, who are basically told that, well, you can make as much money as you want to at the moment. So I think all of that is going on. I mean, essentially, that we have a capitalist country. We're talking about how to get it running again. And this is not really the most significant issue here. The most significant issue is the mistreatment of working class people, the mistreatment of immigrants and migrants. And ironically, at the very same time, you know, we had people from the Caribbean, from Jamaica, coming over, invited after the war to work in the NHS on the buses. And there was the Windrush scandal where some of them were asked to return after decades and decades of being settled in the UK. And the ironic thing is, at the moment, the British government is actually out in Jamaica trying to recruit nurses for the shortfall that we have in the National Health Service. So the crisis on fuel is really part of a much bigger crisis this country is experiencing. And it's something that can only be solved if Britain becomes less insular and if the people of Britain accept the fact that the reality of the situation is that politically, culturally, economically, Britain is part of the world, it's international, and it needs to behave like that instead of shrinking in and trying to become an island fortress.
Mm-hmm. Justin, let's have your comment on that.
Well, you only have to look back at the history of Britain. We may not necessarily be very proud of colonial periods and things like that, but Britain's been its most successful when it has seen itself as an international country operating internationally, whether that's today in modern financial services and things like that, which of course have been hit by Brexit as well, or in terms of trade, but also in terms of accepting in waves of immigrants who really benefited the economy. Whether you're going back to the periods of the pogroms of Russia at the turn of the 20th century, or whether you're dealing with people coming from Armenes, Uganda, you're seeing people who come here and come into society have added astonishing value to it, not just in terms of economic issues, but also in terms of its culture as well. Unfortunately, you then have, it's very easy to whip up, as it were, protectionist, isolationist views, as you saw with President Trump, to be able to say, put America first. Well, actually, no, that's ridiculous. It's much better when a country like Britain realizes it's an international player, that's what it's always done, and it is at most successful when it is at most open to other people, accepting of their cultures, and being able to actually help the economy. And so we're being very short-sighted, unfortunately, if we're just going to bow and let populist politicians get away with it. That's stupid.
Ken, as you know, the average age of drivers in Britain is 55 years old, and they are retiring, and the industry hasn't made that job attractive either. And the UK needs 100,000 truck drivers. So what's the solution?
Well, the solution is not around 100,000. It's not about average age. None of those issues are as important as the fundamental rights of working class people in this country. So whilst any measures the government puts in or the industry suggests are necessary for them to be able to maintain their distribution, maintain their profit making, really the fundamental questions that should come out of this, people should be asking, what kind of country does Britain want to be? How do people want to live? What kind of society do they want? And what do they want to get out of it beyond the selfishness that we've seen, even in terms of the panic buying over the past 3 or 4 days or week. Essentially, every crisis, as Naomi Klein outlined, has the benefit of some people. There will be always people that benefit from the crisis. So there was no need for this so-called fuel crisis. In fact, it's not even a crisis. It's just an opportunity for the government to reassert its control. And even though they may appear to be, incompetent and stupid and ineffective, they don't really care. The government is making money out of the situation. The government made money out of COVID, and it will continue to make money. People have to remember that this government was voted in and has behaved intolerably since it took power. It's only interested in a very narrow group of people. It's interested in itself out of making money. There's no commitment to community. There's no commitment to the people. And so for people to be asking the government, the very people who have really abused the country since they took power, is, I think, laughable. And I think people should really not think just beyond filling their petrol up in their car, but really what to do beyond that.
Right. Justin, what's the main part of the problem? Is the driver shortage the main part of the problem or what?
No, it's not. What you've actually got is a huge fragility in terms of the supply system. And when you, as you saw the pandemic, the supply structures were very, very weak indeed. So, people were talking about the impact on holiday presents and such like over a year ago. And this is really before anything to do with truck drivers or anything like that. And bear in mind, the truck drivers issue isn't just a British issue. You've got the same happening throughout Poland and Germany and other elements. Huge numbers shorting. People have not come back to that work. Why? Well, primarily because over the past two decades, you've had people being able to develop the gig economy. That's to say, you are paid immediately for what you do by the hour with very little social responsibility to your position and how your rights are respected. That is now changing. And those drivers are staying, or those obviously retiring, people not going into this part of the industry because it's not paying well enough. Their services are supporting it a very incredibly weak. So why should they bother? There are other things they can go and do. And of course they can now do that because there are less people around to work because an awful lot have gone back to the rest of Europe, and there is now a huge demand. It's not just lorries, but also just look at, say, the service and leisure sector. Mm. If I go to a restaurant or a pub or something like that, it is immediately noticeable that you have lost probably 25 to 30% of people who would normally be working there because they're not available. They've gone back to Europe, or they turn around and said, I'm not prepared to work, frankly, these tiny pay levels, and therefore there are other things I can go and do because there are lots of other jobs that will be available and give them more. So the economy has to change. This is an inflection point, not just in Britain, but also actually in certain areas throughout the rest of Europe as well.
Okay. On that note, we'll come to the end of this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We have co-founder of the regional investment platform, Justin Urquhart Stewart, and filmmaker and activist Ken Farrow, both of them in London. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
In the limelight. Brioni Worthington, founder and board member of the new not-for-profit Climate Action Group, said, by sharing and channeling data, we can maximize our efforts to combat carbon emissions and global warming. In other words, data is going to be the new water. We'll prepare for you an article written by Robin McKee. The piece is titled, How Data Could Save Earth from Climate Change. SUBEC may seem an odd choice for a new organization that aims to accelerate high-tech efforts to combat climate crisis. The name is Indonesian, it transpires, and refers to an ancient agricultural system that allows farmers to coordinate their efforts when irrigating and growing crops. Brioni Worthington, founder and board member of the new not-for-profit Climate Action Group, said, SUBEC allows farmers to carefully synchronize their use of water and so maximize rice production. She added, and that is exactly what we're going to do with data. By sharing and channeling data, we can maximize our efforts to combat carbon emissions and global warming. In other words, data is going to be the new water. SUBEC will be officially launched in the coming days and will select and fund non-profit groups working around the world to combat the climate crisis. Early startups already helped by SUBEC include one group that is assisting UK local authorities to boost electric car use, while another group is using accurate weather forecasts to make best use of solar power across Britain and limit fossil fuel burning to generate electricity. These efforts are being launched after a week of headlines that have highlighted how perilous life on Earth is becoming as global heating grips the planet. Floods in Germany and Belgium left more than 150 people dead. Scientists revealed that the Brazilian rail forest now emits more carbon dioxide than it absorbs. And wildfires devastated vast tracts of Californian forests. In each case, scientists warned that rising temperatures triggered by increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are likely to have played a key role in bringing about these catastrophes. Briony Worthington, a noted climate activist and lead author of the team which drafted the UK's 2008 Climate Change Act, legislation that required the UK to reduce its carbon emissions by at least 80% of their 1990 levels, says urgent action is clearly needed. At the time, Worthington was working with Friends of the Earth, but was seconded to government to help design the legislation. For her efforts, she was made a peer in 2010. Since then, Briony Worthington has continued in the battle against the climate crisis, and in 2019 she read Harvard academic Shoshana Zuboff's book The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, which focuses, disapprovingly, on high-tech companies' growing use of personal data to make money. Briony Worthington says, "It woke me up to the fact that a whole new world of digital tools was being deployed to generate profits." She added, "I realized it would be better if those tools could be used to save the planet, to protect the global commons, and not merely to boost share value." Worthington contacted G. Fernando, a technology entrepreneur, and the pair hatched the idea of SUBAC, which has since been given funding by the Quadrature Climate Foundation, QCF, that was recently set up by the London investment management company Quadrature Capital. Its aim is to provide initial funding to help groups establish themselves, but also to give expert guidance over legal management and other issues. G. Fernando says, "When you start up a company or group, you are quite alone," adding, "So if you have a community around you that can offer help, human resources, finance, tools, that is incredibly helpful. And then, once the group gets on their feet, they can then start to help other startup entrepreneurs wanting to open new avenues in order to help fight climate change." Fernando's words are echoed by several of the groups that SUBAC has already helped to set up, such as Open Climate Fix. This aimed to reduce carbon emissions by improving weather forecasts to make the best use of solar power plants, whose effectiveness is reduced when the weather is cloudy. Open Climate Fix's co-founder Jack Kelly said, "If we get very good data about forthcoming cloud cover, we will know exactly how much solar-generated electricity can be provided in the United Kingdom on a given day," adding, "That will mean we will not need to generate unnecessary electricity from other sources, in particular fossil fuel sources, such as gas, because we have underestimated the solar power we will get that day. That will help to reduce carbon emissions." Jack Kelly added, "SUBAC's provision of engineers and software experts who have turned weather satellite images into cloud cover forecasts was a critical piece of assistance." A similar tale is told by Richard Allen of New Automotive, which is monitoring new electric cars are being taken up in communities across the United Kingdom. Factors include vehicle use, sales patterns, and favorite types of cars and trucks. That data can be fed to local authorities to ensure charging stations, battery replacement services, and other resources are provided to maximize take-up of electric cars. Richard Allen says, "Replacing petrol and diesel vehicles with electric versions as quickly as possible is going to be extremely important in reducing carbon emissions." He adds, "And data about take-up rates in communities will be vital in achieving that goal." This view is endorsed by Briony Worthington. She says, just a major corporation, has lots of different companies under its control. Subak is going to help set up lots of new outfits, each aimed at boosting efforts to control climate change. Climate crisis in numbers, 415. The number of parts per million of carbon dioxide that make up the atmosphere. Before the Industrial Revolution in the mid-1700s, the global average amount of carbon dioxide was about 280 parts per million. Burning fossil fuels has since added a further 135 parts per million, and if global energy demand continues to grow and is met mostly with fossil fuels, that figure could exceed 900 parts per million by 2100. 3.6 millimeter. The estimated increase each year in sea level, according to measurements of tide gauges and satellite data. This is a result of human-induced warming of the planet. It is projected that the sea level will rise a further 40 to 80 centimeters by 2100, although future ice sheets melt could make these values considerably higher. 43.1 billion. In 2019, that was the number of tons of carbon dioxide from human activities that were emitted into the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas that absorbs heat and releases it gradually over time, like bricks in a fireplace after the fire goes out. Current increases in greenhouse gases has tipped the Earth's energy budget out of balance, trapping additional heat and raising Earth's average temperature. 28 trillion, the estimated number of tons of ice that our planet has lost between 1994 and 2017. Global warming has a particularly severe impact at higher latitudes, and this has been most noticeable in the Arctic region. Scientists worry that as ice melts, less solar radiation will be reflected back into space and temperatures will rise even faster. Ice loss will become increasingly severe as a result.